Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
You know, we were walking for ages in around different corners, and we went into this room with two other men, and there's some three of them and two of us. We hadn't a clue where we were, and you're just thinking, what the hell are we at?
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 20 of Behind the Lines, our sports writing podcast here in the 42, exclusively for you members. I'm Gavin Cooney. This was a fortnightly podcast. It's a weekly podcast at the moment because, hey, we all have a bit more time in our hands. Reminder to please get in touch with us. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me. I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of that are in the episode description of this podcast. This week's guest is the chief sports writer of the Irish Daily Star, Kieran Cunningham. So let's stop messing around and get right to it. Kieran Cunningham, thanks so much for doing the show. How are you?
I'm good. Stuck at home like so many people, but I normally work from home, but still it's a strange feeling because you do feel more hemmed in, and also there's very little to write about. So
the nostalgia pieces are going to go into overdrive, I think, over the next few weeks.
I kind of thought they were anyway, because one of the things with the lack of access in sport the last few years is we've done a lot more nostalgia across the media, and it started to get a bit wearying for me. So now I think we've no choice but to be even more indulgent that way.
Let's kick off by chatting a little bit about yourself, Kieran, if you're not too bashful. Like, when did you first become aware that there's this thing called sports writing and that you perhaps wanted to do it?
Oh, God. That's a very good question. I would say some of the people you've had on, you know, would say they always wanted to be journalists or always wanted to be a sports writer, always passionate about it. I was very much fell into it accidentally. I'd never thought this is what I'd end up doing. And I still have a bit of imposter syndrome that it's got like, what the hell are you doing with sport? Like, what do you know about it? Like, how have you ended up doing it for nearly 30 years? And like everybody's ambitions, like my ambition was to be the goalkeeper for Liverpool while simultaneously being the lead singer for Echo and the Bunny. that was maybe been a tad too ambitious. I'm from Glencoe, Kiln, Donegal. I ended up going to college and did an English degree in Trinity. I was mostly involved in dance and Trinity and music, and the music was what I wanted to do. What part of the business I'd end up in, but it was like I finished college in 89, and eventually I figured I had to do something. I went to Italy I did a TEFL course, taught English in Bologna in Italy for a year. I came back, and FOSS, I figured I have to do something. Like, I was 24, 25. So I looked at a list of FOSS courses, and I was interested in doing one in video production. I thought that might be interesting, and that was booked out. And the number two choice was radio journalism, and I did a course on that in Waterford. And the radio thing, I was quite interested in doing radio documentaries. But at the end of that, there was a work placement, and I wanted to do part of the work placement in RTE. And the only place with a vacancy was Radio Sport. So I went in there for a week or two, and then I was supposed to go to 98FM News. And because they knew I'd done a bit in sport in RTE for a week or whatever it was, they asked me to cover a few matches, and it just went from there. Like, it's completely unexpected. Like, the first things I had printed, like, I did a few Irishman's Diaries with Irish Times, like, which were in Dylan Thomas and American Communist Peter Rockwell Kent. Like, there was far from sport as you could get. And it's just, you fall into something and it becomes your life. And you sometimes wonder, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to say that's an Echo in the Bunningham reference, but it's not. It's the Talking Heads. I'm a bit of a Philistine. So what were the first... Can you remember what were the first games that you covered for 98FM?
Well, it was mostly League of Ireland back then. And also, there was very, like, rugby was very different. Like, it was even the All-Ireland League was only starting. Like, Munster, Leinster, you know, Connacht, Ulster, they just played in Interpros, which nobody was at. And he used to cover, like, a floodlit competition in Old Belvedere on Wednesday nights. Remember, there'd be nobody at it. That was one of the things he used to cover. I then started covering GAA championship games. But I remember, Like, I would go, like, that was the old knockout championship. I remember I'd go up to, I remember covering it, it was a huge game at the time, a Derry-Tyrone game in Celtic Park in Derry. And you get a bus up and down and cover that. So, that's a fair, you know, from leaving the house to getting back, it's what probably took me 12, 13, 14 hours. And I used to get £12 for it. Like, you get no mileage. I mean, I was still working in the Stag's Head for a couple of years when I was freelancing. So, but I was lucky that the second year I was freelancing, Donegal won the All-Ireland for the first time, which was, incredible for being from Donegal and just thinking you would never be involved in those kind of days. So, it just went for that. Like, I ended up, I got to know Robert, just from covering League of Ireland, I got to know a guy called Robert Reid, who's not in the scene anymore, but he was the soccer car for The Sun, and he got me to cover a few games of The Sun. And then at the time, their Irish edition was produced in London in Wapping in the main offices. And he told me they were looking for somebody to go over and do a bit of sub-editing. And you know, it was freelance. It was only a few shifts. And there wasn't much work here, like in Ireland in the early 90s. So I went over and it just built very quickly. It snowballed. I'd never been in a newspaper office before. And you were going to what was a paper selling 4 million a day at the time. And Kevin McKenzie, who was an infamous editor, around ranting and raving. And it was a real culture shock. What was even more of a culture shock, it was a few months after I was there, the guy who was, there were only two of us in the Irish desk, and the other guy there went on holiday to Thailand and he never came back.
Oh.
And this was a couple of weeks before the 1994 World Cup. So I was told, like, okay, you have to be the sports editor. And I hadn't a notion. I hadn't a clue. And it was literally been thrown in at the deep end. But I, for family reasons, I came back from London a couple of years ago. I worked in Cork and even Echo for a while, and then I got a job in the Star. And I ended up as acting sports editor in the Star for 2.5 years. So I've been on the desk in the Echo as well, and I did sub editing shifts in the Sunday Times in Ireland. I've been on the desk as well as reporting. I think that's a big help, because even if you're writing, when you're out writing, if you're used to having been subbing and having to change things very quickly and having, it helps with rewrites, it helps with deadlines, it helps with the practicalities of it. Like, I would always advise people to do both, to have done both, because it does help.
Mm, what's better?
I've been out and about, you know, yeah. And I hated subbing. I hated being on the desk. Just even the hours are a killer. And you're not actually, you know, you're covering sport, but you're not at sport, you know, so... Like, there's different pressures. Like, in a way, you know, you prefer the desk in a way because people are giving you stuff. You're there and you deal with whatever they give you. But, and there's huge pressure on to get interviews week after week. And as you know, like, you're in the Daily Beat now. The Daily Beat wears people down. Like, I see I'm 53 now. A hell of a lot of journalists seem to leave in their 40s from dailies. And I think that's part that is very, very hard to keep going day after day after day, because it never reads it. Like, you see it now, sport is a roller coaster. The same events come around year after year. Like, you're going the Masters, the start of the GAA Championship, the start of the Premier League, blah, blah, blah. And all of them is a big deal, and you have to bring out pullouts or do special things around them. And that becomes very hard after a while. To come up with something fresh and new angles, you know, it takes its toll on people.
Yeah. So you obviously got out and about quite a bit. What memories or what events stick out in your mind as among your favourites?
Well, the most memorable one I was at was a Monday night at the Sydney Olympics. That was the first Olympics I covered. And it was the night Sonia O'Sullivan got her silver medal. But it wasn't like that was incredible to be there for that. But it wasn't just about Sonia as well. I don't know if you remember, if you've read about it since, but Kathy Freeman, you know, was huge deal at those Olympics, because she was an Aboriginal woman who lit the flame, who at 400 meters, she was the favorite for the 400 meters. And a huge amount of responsibility was put on her shoulders, like a huge amount of pressure. I don't think anybody was under as much pressure at the Olympics, because basically they were saying, you're proof that Australia's changed, that we've made peace with our past, and the usual kind of shite that people come out with. But it wasn't fair on her, an athlete competing at it. And She won it, but I remember, I think she just kind of collapsed to the track at the end. It took so much out of her. As well as that, and that same evening, there was the best 10,000 meter final of all time when Gebre Selassie beat Moses Kiptunui in the last stride, literally the last stride of a race which is over 6 miles. It was the first time there was a women's pole vault final at the Olympics, which ended up being hugely entertaining. Jonathan Edwards won his last gold in the triple jump that evening, and Michael Johnson ran his last ever race. He won gold that evening. So that all happened in the space of 2 hours. So it was, and like, it was a balmy night. Like, you know, the weather was beautiful. Like, it was just, it was really a privilege to be there. You know, the other one I'd say was a very strange one, but it was in Istanbul when Liverpool won the Champions League. Coming to 3-0 down. And like, I would have been a Liverpool fan from being a kid. Like, you know, as you get older, you become more detached, I think, or you should do anyway, but it comes back at times. But that was very strange because it was incredible to be there, but because you were rewriting so much because you had to file on the whistle, it was very hard to dig in what was happening because you had a lot of it written at half time. Because like, it was basically, you know, this night shows how far Liverpool have fallen. European elite, blah, blah, blah. Like, you were thinking then it was going to be 6 or 7 nil, you know. And then when it's 3-1, you don't really change. Then 3-2, you have to start changing. Then 3-3, you know, you don't know what to do right then. Like, everything's redundant because it could go either way, particularly when it ends up going to penalties because the result dictates copy so much and, you know, to an unfair degree. But like, if Milan had won that penalty shootout, like, how would you write about that game? I've never really thought about that. Yeah. Well, you still say there's a great comeback. No, well.
Yeah, because way it is, but, you know. When people talk to sports journalists, they're like, and you get tickets to see all these amazing events for free. Actually, you're not. It's not just free. You're paid to be there. But is it actually possible to sit and enjoy these events? Like, between Istanbul was such a roller coaster, and then that night in Sydney, there's like 5, 6, 7 like era defining stories happening within a couple of hours, and you're like, holy shit, I probably have to write about all of these. Is it possible to enjoy it, or is it just absolutely frantic, and then it's something to reflect on a couple of days later and be like, oh.
I think it depends on the circumstances. For this reason, Gavin, that was a Monday night in Sydney, which was, I think, Tuesday morning here. And at the time, you know, it was just, you know, the online wasn't really a thing. So your deadline was, you had plenty of time to write for, like, it wasn't going to be in that morning's paper. It was going to be, you know, you had 12, 13 hours to write up the piece, whatever. So that you could enjoy that. You know, you could just sit there and watch that evening sport, get the quotes after, go back to your hotel and think about it and then write it up. But in an evening game, I find them impossible to enjoy. Yeah. Or even weekend games now where, you know, you're filing on the whistle at a big GA championship game. You know, you have to get quotes. You might be ghosting a column or something. I find increasingly that I really only enjoy sport when I'm not working or I don't have to write about it the next day. If I'm under deadline pressure, I find it really hard to get the same enjoyment because the workload has increased with on the whistle and close to the whistle and more is expected of you. You just don't take it in the way you should. Like, I sometimes go to games now when I don't have to do anything, just to be able to just relax and remember what it's like to just be even have a pint before a game, or, you know, just have a chat with a mate at it. Like, I much prefer doing interviews now than go to live events, because live events, even still things now, because people want more stats. They want you to count frees and all that kind of stuff. I have no interest in that. I have to be honest. And it really affects my enjoyment of the game. Like, I have dyspraxia. And one of the things with dyspraxia is that you can be very distracted. Like, I would always be seen as a bit of a daydreamer. Like, it's very hard to stay focused. And I think to do proper match reports, you have to be very, very focused. And I find I don't have the concentration levels for that. Whereas writing a colour piece is easier because you can just latch on to one thing in particular. And you can have an idea even in your head beforehand you could say, like, I'm just going to watch Virgil van Dijk in this game or whatever. But if you have to actually give a full picture of the game, I find it pretty challenging. I would never read my match reports back. Everybody else should read, not me.
I was going to say I struggle with the same things, but I cover Irish football matches and they're all 1-0 anyway, so I can pretty much write it ahead of time.
Yeah, because there are, like, I read your description of the Flores goal. It was a brilliant description. And what struck me with that is because of the night game, you know, you can sometimes, when you are under deadline pressure, like, it's tempting often to have an idea in your mind of what you're going to write about, or have a couple of alternatives just because you're under pressure and say, you know, I'll go on this angle that these are the two clubs of the future and which one is on the right path or blah, blah, blah. But you could never you can't legislate for something like what Flores did. So you have to respond to the moment. And that's what you did there. And that's, you know, that can be very challenging. Like, you can't just say Flores fired home from a corner 20 minutes into the first half or something, blah, blah, blah. And Dundalk win the ascendancy or whatever. You know, you have to, like, this was a wow moment and you have to come up with wow pros. Like, I have looked at some reporters over the years and, like, it could be a Kilkenny Tipperary All-Ireland final and they're going for the five in a row. And then it reads like a league match in February. Like, you have to respond to the occasion. And I think, you know, you do people, I think Keith Duggan is brilliant at that. Dennis Walsh in Sunday Times, you know. Enda McAvoy, an examiner. Some people, you know, they give you more when the occasion demands more. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, just before we get to your picks, actually, like, we're now, like, most people are moving to, if they're not solely online, they're online first. Yet everyone is still writing to deadlines set by newspapers. Do you, like, sometimes I wonder, while I can understand why there's a thirst for want of a much better phrase, for content from fans after matches, I always kind of wonder, well, why are we still rushing this? I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think a lot of things could change the way sports media works. You know, that's been honest. Like there's so many sponsors gigs and commercial gigs now that people cover, most people cover automatically. And they take up a lot of reporters' times, and very rarely is there anything out of them. You know, I would just get a couple of freelancers and tell them cover all of those. If there's anything in them, send it through. If you think there's something in it, send it through. If we think it's decent, we'll run it. But don't waste, people who you're paying a full time salary. You know, and in some cases, significant salary. Don't waste their time on that kind of stuff that is just filler. And there's also the thing about everybody having the same stuff. I've no interest in everybody having the same stuff. Like, The Athletic got a bit of a hammering, and it still gets slagged because some of its stuff is very esoteric. But its first weekend, people were shocked that there weren't match reports, there weren't the quotes from the post-match press conferences. But that stuff is everywhere.
Yeah.
So if you're trying a different model and trying to make it work and get a lot of people signed up and paid a huge amount of money to the people you've recruited, why would you ask them just to file the same quotes that 10 other reporters have filed? I think people are very, in a way, very stuck in their ways in what they think you should get out of sports media. And it does have to change. You know, it's like, I can see in newspapers often, I read a feature and it's really good, and I think it's too short because there's constraints in space, and that can be down to the way the paper is designed, or a big ad or whatever, or a reluctance to give a third page. Like, the papers will be usually only give one page or two pages to a piece, no matter how good it is. And the opposite problem is, like, you guys work online, and I see with a lot of online features, they're far too long.
Yeah.
You know, there can be that they need more editing, you know, so there's problems on both sides of it that way, that sometimes I'm going through an online feature, I think this is really good, but then after a while I think, how long is this? And sometimes, and fairly often I give up, I think it's just too long. And, you know, there's one of the reasons, like, that I picked Patrick Kavanagh piece, it's about 500 words, because most of the stuff we rave about, you know, and we talk about it, there's a lot of talk about long form journalism and a revival of it and a need for it, and I agree with that, because I think it's been kind of shown that clickbait doesn't work. you know, and it's interesting, like Le Monde in France have gone for fewer pieces, but giving people more time to do them. So putting the emphasis on quality. And like, it's one of the reasons I didn't pick any American writers for this, because it's very easy to do that. Like, I could pick loads of pieces that David Remnick wrote, or Gay Talese, or Gary Smith, or whoever, and they're outstanding pieces. But you look at the way they worked. They had months and months to do pieces, and they were often they were generally very well paid. They were very well resourced. Like, I recently read a book by George Plimpton, Shadowbox, I think it's called, and a lot of it is about covering the Muhammad Ali George Foreman fight in Zaire. And that fight was cancelled halfway through because of an injury. But all the journalists stayed on. And like, Hunter S. Thompson was one of those who was there. And he'd write, he was there in Africa, I think, 3 or 4 months. He'd write one piece for Rolling Stone. It was probably a very long piece, probably 10 or 12,000 words. But I honestly think, Gavin, if you were given 3 or 4 months in Africa with those kind of characters, Muhammad Ali, Don King, James Brown, George Foreman, all those people around, you'd come up with an exceptional piece. Like, a lot of people from the past are hugely praised because they came up with brilliant work. But because of circumstances they worked under, it was very conducive to doing really good pieces.
Yeah. And the access as well. Like, I mean, we talked about with Alan English that Hugh McIlvany and another journalist whose name I forget knocked on Muhammad Ali's door and spent a couple of hours with him after the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah, that's what that's precisely it. Like, who wouldn't come up with a brilliant piece if you got 3 or 4 hours of Muhammad Ali? You know, even if you just write the quotes, I guess you get the jobs to sort it out. But it's, you know, everything is a context. Like, Con Hoolihan would be a godlike figure to a lot of people here. But I think part of that is the times he worked in. Like, he was in the back of the Evening Press, and if you read him, it was clear he was literate. There was a lot of colour. There was a lot of flair. He could write well. He had a great turn of phrase and great terms of reference that went way beyond sports. But he stood out because if you look, go into the archives and look at the other pages, sports pages back there, sports writing in Ireland was really poor up till the 1980s, really, outside of Con. So he got, like, nowadays he wouldn't stand out anything as much. And, like, people still go on about his line when Mikey Shee scored the goal against, chipped it over Paddy Cullen's head in the 1978 All-Ireland final, that he was like I can't remember the exact word, but a housewife who left a cake in the oven and was on fire or was burning, or somebody racing back to get the cake, something like that. But I guarantee you, it was a good line. But if you read on big events now these days in the summer, big All-Ireland fans, if you picked up everything that's written on the Monday between online and newspapers, there are plenty of journalists who come up with better lines than that.
Yeah.
You know, the standard has improved across the board under very challenging circumstances. And the other thing about the pieces I picked, other than the Patrick Kavanagh, I picked 3 pieces that are fairly recent. Because I think there's too much nostalgia about the past in sports journalism. Like, it is far more difficult because we don't have the access to it. But that's putting it up to people to be more imaginative. And I think they've had to respond to that.
Just before we get into these pieces, I'm interested in when you say that broadly the standard in the 80s in Ireland was poor, then Con Hoolihan obviously stood out. What changed? Was there a particular publication or a group of people, in your opinion, that changed it maybe through the 90s to the extremely high standard that we have now?
Yeah, one of the big changes was McGill magazine. Like, Eamon Dunphy was a big change. Like, Eamon is a very divisive figure now because his punditry, I think he got bored with his punditry long before he left RTE. But his Matt Busby book is one of the best sports, A Strange Kind of Glory, is one of the best sports books you'll ever read. When the Sunday of the Pen brought out their anthology of sports writing, his pieces, I thought, were a level above the rest. Like, it really, it was easy to forget how good he was. So you had Eamon Dunphy, you had David Walsh, you had Colm Tobin writing on sport in the McGill. He was editor of McGill, but he sometimes wrote about sport as well. He wrote a great piece about Diego Maradona, I think, for Esquire magazine. That was a change. The Sunday Tribune as well was kind of, because that was a Vincent Brown, both Vincent Brown. Vincent Brown edited both McGill and Sunday Tribune. He was a founder of both. And he put more emphasis on sports writing. And, you know, he brought in the likes of Eamon Dunphy, David Walsh, Paul Kimmage, you know, Dennis Walsh later on. That was the big change, I think. That was the most significant change.
Yeah. Well, let's get stuck into these picks now because they're terrific. As I was saying before, they are recent. So I read them all at the time of their publication, bar A Gut Your Man by Patrick Kavanagh. Tell us a little bit about this piece, Kieran, and why you picked it.
Well, let me just call it up here. The reason I picked it was, let me find the bloody thing. Okay. The GA is such a central part of Irish life, but it's been ignored largely by Irish writers, which is very strange. You know, it's very interesting to try and figure out the reasons why. John McGahern has a couple of stories. He references it. Seamus Heady, Bernard O'Donoghue, a couple of poems. Tom McIntyre, who was a goalkeeper for Cavan, he wrote a bit about it. But there are very few other examples. And there was a huge snobbery among the literati towards the GA. And even, you know, in the broader culture, like I remember Hot Press was a bigger deal in the 80s than it is now. Like it used to be quite a significant magazine. And there was a lot of sneering in Hot Press. They used to call Gaelic football bog ball and hurling stick fighting. Yeah. And that kind of thing went on. Like, you know, this was like why the GA was in no way sexy to the, you know, to a lot of people. And so the cabinet thing struck me for a couple of reasons. I think there's a lack of humor in a lot of sports writing. This in many ways very funny. It's very true if you know GA. Like this was written in the early 1930s, which is nearly 90 years ago, and you know it's still true to the way clubs are these days. Like he was involved in clubs, his club at administrative level, and he was a goalkeeper, and it's just. Like I can't remember where it's originally from, but like it's known as Gut Your Man. Like that's what it's called. But like there's a few lines I just read out. I love the team we were playing were a disgusting class of a team. He used every form of psychological warfare. For instance, when one of them was knocked down, he rolled on the ground and bawled like a bull a gelding. Like that, you could write that about Atletico Madrid.
I was thinking of using that phrase on Neymar sometime. I bowl like a bull a gelding. I don't think he'd understand it.
Yeah, I love this. We never finished a game. Towards the end, we were abated. We always found an excuse to rise a row and get the field invaded. But there was one in particular I really love. Let me find this. Well, the ball hungry one. I love that. For weeks they wouldn't train without a ball. Before a county final, so they'll be ball hungry for the final. There was one, where is it, about a normal row? Can you remember what that is? Blah, blah, blah. I love that. Let me find this. You need a good Monaghan accent to read this, I think, as well. Kavanagh, the dirty Egypt. How could he be an Egypt and him a poet? One of our supporters replied. Blah, blah, blah.
Kavanagh loved the idea of the poet. Did you read that story? There was an embargo on it. It was like one of these 100-year embargoes was lifted a couple of years ago, where Kavanagh went into a bookshop. It might have been, I can't remember where it was actually, but his book wasn't in the front window, and he went in and started to tear the whole thing down until the bookshop owner put his book in the window, and then he roared at them, "You must obey the law of the poet," which is something I really want to say at some point in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he was a very nice man. Like, if you read Anthony Cronin's memoir, Dead as Doornails, you know, about those, you know, Flann O'Brien, Brendan Behan, Patrick Kavanagh, etc. Like, it was very sordid, like, the drinking, the way they lived. You know, there was a lot of depression. Like, it was pretty bleak in many ways. But this is the line, I love this bit. Then there was a time I pulled the ball over the goal line and a most useless non-playing member of the opposing team kicked it back into play. We argued and there was a normal row. I love that. But no, that's I think it's a brilliant piece. Like it's there's a great story. I think it was Michael Moynihan you had on, and Michael Moynihan mentioned Brendan O'Hara's book Over the Bar. He picked that, which is a brilliant book, but. There's a great story in that about Samuel Beckett. I don't know if he mentioned it to you. Meeting a priest with Brendan Behan. Did he mention that story to you?
No, but I know it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll tell it again. I love telling it because like, if you know anything about Beckett, he was a huge sportsman. He loved cricket, loved rugby in particular, but he wouldn't have been very much inclined towards the GA, even though he does. He mentions Camogie and Waiting for Godot. There's another GA reference, one of the only in Lucky Speech. But he was walking out with Brendan Behan and Gunnar to visit Beckett in Paris. And they were out walking and they bumped into a priest who was at the Irish College in Paris at the time. And he was quite an innocent character. And he said to him, so Mr. Beckett, you know, do you go to Dublin much? And he said, no. He said, Anna. He said, well, I have been invited in September. He said, September? What time in September? The middle of the month, I think. You'll miss the hurling, but you'll be there for the football. There you go. Always worth recycling, guys.
Yeah, just you mentioned Hot Press there in the GA. I remember I read a line by Bill Graham, who used to work in Hot Press, and he described the USSR as, imagine an entire continent run by the GAA.
I
kind of find it strange that the GA was kind of neglected by Irish literature. When you think, like, the Irish literary revival back in the day put so much stock in ancient figures like Cú Chulainn and so on, and, you know, Cú Chulainn, you know, famously picked up a hurl and lashed its litter down a dog's throat. Take things literally. I don't know. Do you have any other theories on why GA was neglected?
It was a very different GA. Like, if that Bill Graham line is from the early 80s, the GA was a very, very conservative and insular organization at that time. You know, that was, you know, the ban on so-called foreign games had only gone, you know, a decade earlier. It only went 72. You know, the ban on members of the RUC and playing was still in place. The ban on, you know, you still couldn't play soccer, rugby on GA grounds at the time. So, and there was huge resistance to any of that kind of change. So the GA was seen very much as being, you know, it's brought up by a lot of people that there were three pillars: the Catholic Church, the Fianna Fáil, and the GA. And they were all seen as very darkly, very conservative and very much official Ireland. So a lot of writers would have seen themselves against official Ireland, I would have thought. So maybe they just bracketed them all in together.
Yeah, you mentioned Dunphy. His predecessor as a football pundit on RTE, who was both curmudgeonly and wrong a lot of the time, was actually Kavanagh. I was just digging around. He wrote this piece of the RTE Guide ahead of the 66 World Cup, and said, yeah, and I agree with everyone that England have almost no chance of winning. And sadly got it wrong. He also claimed that, I think he might have been joking, that Eusebio was named in honour of Eusebio Cassidy, who was in a novel of
The Green Fool, was it? The Green Fool or Terry Flynn, again, it was one of those. Yeah.
Terry Flynn, yeah. Which kind of reminds me, did you ever hear the story, and I know it's true, of where Jimmy McGee claimed to have given Pele his nickname?
Well, I know Jimmy has said that many times. I don't know if it's true. I read Pele's autobiography as a kid, but I remembered nothing about it, except there was a lot of God in it, and even then that put me off.
God and no Jimmy McGee in that autobiography. Apparently, just because I have the story open here, because it's after popping into my head, that that Pele and Jimmy McGee met back in the early 70s, and apparently Pele said he didn't know where he got his nickname, so McGee suggested he had an idea, and he gave him a story that there was an Irish-speaking missionary priest in Brazil, in Pele's poor part, who was born and raised, and he would watch the young Edson play on the street with a bowl of paper, and the priest said, "Bukaleg imirch Pele," and on hearing the phrase, the local woman called the boy Pele. Make as much of that as you wish. Let's drive on to pick number two, which is a piece that appeared in the Irish Examiner late in 2018 by Cathal Dennehy, athletics journalist, on the rivalry between the Irish athletes Thomas Chamney, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and David Campbell. Tell us a little bit about this piece. It's brilliant.
The reason at the newspaper awards, like I won't say media awards because it's very, we talk about insular, but the newspaper awards, their journalism awards are insular as well. They only include some journalists. But he got Sports Writer of the Year in the broadsheet category. for this. This was one of the three pieces you put in. I was delighted you put it in because there's too much focus to me on the big sports here. Like it's too much soccer, GA, rugby, horse racing, golf to an extent. And people, you know, those are seen as the drivers of sales and circulation or clicks or whatever you want to say. And I always think there's an appetite for good stories, no matter what they are. And if you went to, you know, if you were going to an editor with that and saying, this is about a rivalry between two Irish athletes, he said, who are the two Irish athletes? Thomas Chamney, David Campbell. A lot of editors would never heard of either of them. Like, Thomas Chamney went to the 2008 Olympics, but he went on a B standard. They were both 800 meter runners. He went on a B standard and, you know, finished down the field in his heat, made no mark. David Campbell never made it to the Olympics. None of them have any major medals. So you could talk that, you know, you could see why editors would be saying, why would you run this? And then you read what Cahill got out of the two of them, and you see why Cahill would be the best athletic journalist I've ever seen in Ireland, come out of Ireland by a mile. In that and it helps, like, it is quite interesting in Ireland. A lot of very good sports writers have a sporting background, like Joe Brawley and Paul Kimmage. Tom O'Riordan back in the day was an Olympian. And Cahill was a very, you know, Cahill competed for Ireland at under 23 level at the European Cross Country Championships. A very good runner, very, very promising runner. But he knew this, he knows the scene, he knows the kind of stories that went on there. And there was just, and it's just a story of an incredibly bitter rivalry. And that they're very open about, they hated each other. No, and people are very reluctant to use that kind of language, you know, because it's, you know, people do go in for the whole band of brothers thing. And, you know, we're all part of the, you know, if I don't get the Olympics, I'd be delighted if another Irishman goes instead. No, you know, Thomas Chamney went in 2008 and Campbell was very bitter of it. 2012, Campbell tried very hard to make it. He didn't. And he went on the Wild Atlantic Way while the London 2012 Olympics was on. So we wouldn't have to watch a minute of it. Like people, there's a rawness in the piece. Like I would encourage anyone to dig it out. I don't know David Campbell at all, but I've done a few things with Thomas Chamney over the years. Thomas is very outspoken and he can be very acerbic. So he's always very good value. But like, I didn't know the depth of this. Like, I remember reading stuff about this big rivalry, but it was a big rivalry at the national championship. Have you ever been to national championships? No. Outside of the athletes and coaches, there's often a couple of hundred people there max. Like, it can be, it's very low key. But to the people involved, it wasn't low key at all. It was a huge deal, a massive deal.
I'm going to read the intro because it's absolutely brilliant. But listener, do be aware that I am going to swear quite badly in this twice. So advance apologies. Ever wonder how it fades? The bad blood and bitterness spilled in the sporting arena. The dislike and disdain between two rivals who would, if the opportunity arose, happily put their fist through the other man's face. Well, let's start with this. At the Great North Run in Newcastle last year, David Campbell, a retired international athlete from Kildare, was introduced to an affable American, Mario, who soon flagged his accent, his age, and his background as a middle-distance runner. "Irish," he said. "You must know Tom Chamney." "Yeah," said Campbell. "He's a cunt." Mario's face dropped. "You do know that me and Tom are friends. We see each other on a regular basis." "Really?" said Campbell, pausing for a moment. "He's still a cunt." Which is, you know, I mean, you don't go quoting that word too often, but it packs a pretty powerful punch when you want to use it. And it's just a terrific piece. And it, like, the story weaves so well, weaves together so well, tells the two athletes' lives separately. Then they come together in this, what is essentially a race off for a place in the Beijing Olympics. And it turns out the Chamney is told that this is the winner of this race essentially gets to go on a B standard time to Beijing, and Campbell doesn't know that, and Campbell claims that Chamney wasn't upfront about it, and there's that bitterness and anger. And then Chamney is great about how he was motivated by the rivalry. There was an Olympic Council of Ireland gathering in 2009 for athletes to share knowledge and to see who could learn what off each other, and Chamney was asked to explain his tactics And he says, I've only one tactic, beat David Campbell every single time, with Campbell sitting in the room. But it ends up like it turns out that Chamney kind of almost needed the rivalry. It ends with, I loved having Campbell around and I have to thank him a lot for it. It was good, honest bitterness and rivalry. There's such a dichotomy between us, but we were at our best around the same time and going at each other hammer and tongs. Oh, fuck, it was brilliant. The best of times. Isn't that a masterpiece?
Yeah, well, rivalry is at the heart of sport. You know, whether it's Borg and McEnroe or Ali Fraser or Kilkenny, Tipperary or Dublin Kerry, whatever you want to say. Like, you do need... like, that's one of the reasons that so many people tuned out of the Premier League this year is that it looked like a great rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester City, but City fell off. You know, you do need that kind of that edge to it. But, you know, it's interesting the way that kind of ends up and Thomas Chamney says, no, it helped them. But I do wonder because... You know, he does mention it, how obsessive he became about it. And you'd think it took up too much of his focus. Like, he mentions Campbell racing in Australia. And Chamney would get up at, 6 or 7 in the morning to check his results. You know, he was abroad another time and he couldn't get online. So he called a friend at home in Clonmel, Tipperary, to tell him exactly how Campbell had run in the Paris Diamond League run. And there's a quote from him, you know, I was paying €1 a minute, roaming charges, just to find out what he was up to. That was the biggest thing in my life for 5 years. I needed that energy, that fucking resentment and bitterness I had towards him. I love it. I get off on it. And, you know, that's really striking and stark. But you wonder, was it counterproductive? You know, did it just take too much energy that might have been focused elsewhere? But I remember reading it at the time. And I just thought, it's one of those, like, you see that with a lot of journalists, there's a fair bit of backslap and people say, oh, great piece and well done. So I never feel like that. Like, it always says such a fair play is a great piece, but I always feel jealous. I think you should. Like, you think that there are only so many good ideas out there. So when you see something like that, you go, fuck it, why didn't I think of that? So that was one of those. Because, like, I know Thomas and I know what he's like as a talker. And if I'd known enough to, you know, that bitterness was that... deep-rooted, you know, you just see there was a great piece there waiting to be written.
Yeah, they're all out there and we need them all over the next few weeks. It's kind of surprising rivalry is probably the theme of another of your picks, Kieran. This piece that Stephen Hunt wrote for the Sunday Independent in December 2014, recalling his time at Euro 2012 under Giovanni Trapattoni. It's kind of interesting that I thought this is episode 20 of this podcast, and I think that this might be the first piece written by a footballer. Sorry, as I say that, I've realised that Eamon Dunphy's been picked loads of times, so scratch that thought. But can you maybe tell us a little bit about this piece, Kieran, and why you picked it?
With the pieces I picked, Gavin, with the pieces I picked, there were different reasons. Like, I wanted to pick the Cabinet piece because... you know, the connection to Irish literature, why don't more people write it? And also because of its length, because it was a short piece. I wanted to pick one short piece. And also, one of the reasons I picked this is it's ghosted. And it's interesting because Dion Fanning ghosted it, because I checked with Dion the other day before, because I knew I was doing this. I just wanted to double check it was Dion that wrote it. And like you see, like Vincent Hogan's book with Paul McGrath, Back in the Break, incredible book. Paul Kimmage's book with Tony Cascarino, Full Time, another brilliant book. A lot of brilliant ghosted books out there. And the ghost often gets a lot of credit, and rightly so, like your own Niall Kelly with Andy Lee, which I think is a fantastic book. But ghosted columns, people rarely get credit. And this is this is Stephen Hunt. If you read this, you know this is what Stephen Hunt went through. You know, there's nothing, you know, it's not been gilded. Nobody's gilding the lily. Nobody's adding on stuff that didn't happen. So there's a lot of Stephen in it, but there's a lot of Dion in it as too. Like, that took an incredible amount of work to get that kind of column out of it. And like, a lot of us have to do a lot of ghosting, and it's a pain in the arse. And it's, you know, it's easy to go through the motions. And you get no credit for it. Like, most people don't know Dion Fanning wrote that, or, you know, it was a collaborative effort. So I think that was one of the reasons I picked it. But also, to me, like, you covered the Irish soccer team now, Gavin. I covered it, you know, been covering it since the early 90s on and off. And that, to me, is the most honest piece I've ever seen. Not necessarily honest, but maybe the piece that told me most about what it's like to be inside their bubble.
Yeah.
And we don't know what it's like. Like, a few years ago, No, not a few years ago. When I started out, journalists sometimes went drinking with the players. Then a few years after that, things became more formalized. So you go to the hotel in the days coming up to games, and you try and corner a player in the lobby who was going for coffee or something to get them to sit down for an interview. Then that became formalized into group, press conference, press days. And it's more formalized now. It's in Abbottstown. It's become far more rigorous, far more controlled than it was.
Yeah.
So we can imagine all we like what it's like to be playing for Ireland, or the pressures they're under, or the rivalries between themselves, but we really haven't a fucking clue.
Yeah.
We really don't have. That's one of the things, I do see that. Like, some journalists get touchy about that, when players or sports people will say, like, what do you really know about it? They'd say to you, you've never been in that position. And we don't. Like, we don't know what kind of pressure James McLean would be on James McLean's shoulders if and when that Slovakia playoff takes place. When, there's been talk of him not playing well. There's been talk of him, he should be dropped. He's at the stage where this might be his only shot at going to another tournament. We have no idea what that pressure feels like. So it's just really revelatory to read somebody being honest about it. And even, there's a bit of the Chamney-Campbell thing in that there's a rivalry with McLean. Like, they're going for the same place. Like, even within a team game, like, he mentions Darren Gibson, the last game against Italy, he didn't get on. He didn't play a minute. I remember him coming through that mix zone after the Italy game, and he had a face like thunder. Like, he'd gone to Poland, like, he'd been in camp for 5 or 6 weeks, didn't get a minute on the pitch. Stephen Hunt was the same. I remember coming out, he was very annoyed. Like, and for all the talk, we're all in it together. Your ego comes into it, and your own ambitions, and it's not, you're looking after your own turf as well.
Yeah, it actually has that quote by Steve Archibald in the piece, that team spirit is an illusion glimpsed in the aftermath of victory. Just for brief background, in case anyone doesn't know, Stephen Hunt was an Irish footballer. He went to Euro 2012. Euro 2012 is this kind of psychic disaster for Ireland. We were put in an admittedly impossibly difficult group with Croatia, Spain and Italy. The latter two qualified for the final. We got battered in all three games. We were out of it by the time Ireland faced Italy, and Ireland, of course, had Giovanni Trapattoni in charge. And Stephen Hunt had been promised that he would get a few minutes, having battled through injury and taken a longer term toll on his career, as he explained in that piece, and ultimately didn't get off the bench. Can we just briefly go back to ghosting? Because it's actually not something, the mechanics of which the qualities of which we've gone into a whole lot on this podcast. And actually, I think listeners would appreciate doing that, because the assumption about ghosting, and the most uncharitable one, is that you press record and then you transcribe what's told you down the phone. So what is different about this? You said a lot of work went into this. What kind of work would have gone into it?
Well, I would say that a huge amount of time from both, like, they would have talked a lot to get that amount of information. And then a lot of thought would have gone into the structure then that Dion put on it. But it varies so much. Like, I've ghosted a lot of different people in different sports over the years. And some people are really hard work. And you ring, they've nothing ready. They've no ideas. You have to put it all together. There are others who'll email you the transcript, or email you what they want to say. And basically, you just have to edit it slightly. Like, there's very little work to be done. So, and I do see that, like we have Eamon McGee now. Eamon writes his own columns. Like, at the start it was ghosted, but he's well able to write it. So we challenged him to do that. And he's well capable of doing that. Gerard Mann is well capable of doing that. So there are people, and I see that with the Examiner and the Sunday Independent, that most of the sports people they use write their own copy. But, ghosting... Like, I think that what people want now, what editors want from a so-called, I don't like the word celebrity columnist, but from a prominent ex-sports person as a columnist, it used to be just the name. Like, we had Ruud Gullit for a while, who was a big name, but he gave you nothing. Like, it was just sexy football, blah, 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 Ruud. But nowadays, I think people want... They want to see behind the curtain a bit more. You know, they want to know, like, and that's, there's been a huge change, like the likes of Darrow Shea and Tomás, you know, all those Shays, Tomás and Mark, the three of them are writing columns, and they're very revelatory. Eamon is very, very honest. And it's just Richie Sadlier, you know, would have been in the Sunday Independent, Stephen Hunt in the Sunday Independent. You know, and there was that, like, that probably changed with Paul Kimmage, to be honest. And Neil Francis then, to an extent, and that was going back to the Tribune. Like, Kimmage was still a cyclist when he started doing diaries, racing diaries for the Tribune. Neil Francis was still playing for Ireland when he did a World Cup diary. He started off. So I think they deserve credit for that, and they deserve credit for getting more out of the sports people than just saying, oh, I'm so proud to pull on the green jersey and this means a lot to us, blah, blah, blah. Like Stania Sullivan, well, she's still doing columns, but she used to do, as an athlete, she did a brilliant column in the Sunday Tribune, but it was supposed to be Paul Howard. Like, it was supposed to be a top-class sports writer. So you do need... the problem these days, or a problem often can be that ghosting now, you might be at a game, you might have to write your piece on the game, get quotes, and then ghost a column. And very tight space of time. So, you know, how much craft can you put into something then? You know, so it depends on, like, often the columns are better if they're a midweek or a Saturday column or whatever, previewing something, that rather than a live column, ghosted column, which is very much under time pressure. Columns. And Brian stopped doing his columns for the Indoor because Brian's columns were excellent, but Brian puts so much into them, and he puts so much into his TV punditry, he didn't feel he could do them justice. And he's given up a fair bit of money to do that. But, like, a lot of people, you know, want it to be something they're proud of now. No, they don't just want it to be a handy earner.
Well, you mentioned the fact that the Sunday Independent have their columnists write themselves, one of whom is Joe Brawley, and he is the author of the fourth and final of your picks. Now, this isn't a column. It's, in fact, an interview with Pater Heffron that appeared in the Sunday Indo a couple of years ago. Can you tell us a bit about this piece, Kieran, and why you picked it?
Yeah, well, I've always been... Joe was 2 years behind me in college. And Joe was very much the same in college as he is now. Like, he's incredible intellect. He can be very funny. He's very. He was very visible. He was a top class footballer. He could be a very good Sigerson Cup team at the time, and, you know, he was the star player on it. But, you know, so I've always kind of kept an eye on him over the years, like from when he was playing with Derry, and then everything he went into afterwards. But what struck a couple of things with this, like, Joe is a very busy working life as a barrister. He was also at the time, like, this was October 2017, he was working for RTE at the time. He was writing a Sunday Independent column, writing a column for the Gaelic Life, and also very much involved in, you know, Up for Life and cystic fibrosis charities. So he doesn't have a huge amount of spare. Also with a family and a coaching, he coaches teams. So he doesn't have a huge amount of spare time. But this thing, he's a brilliant writer. Like, that's, you know, you can slag off, he can be very infuriating, and I would disagree strongly with a lot of things Joe has said and done over the years, said and written as well. But I'd always respect him as a writer, and I think deep down he's a good person. You know, there's a lot to Joe. I have a lot of time for him. But this is somebody, I can't remember who had said it, but the best journalism is angry journalism. And there's a lot of anger in this. It's restrained anger very much on the part of Joe writing it. It's pretty overt on the part of Pater Heffron, which is very understandable. And Pater Heffron was a footballer with Craig and Kim Kickham's, a club in Belfast. And his life changed when he joined the PSNI. And, like, he was told by people within the club and people in the wider GA community not to do this. And because, you know, there were within the broader nationalist community, there was a huge mistrust of the police, going back to the troubles, and you know, the pressure that is put on is often very threatening pressure.
Well, I mean, This guy, Pádraig Héireann, was getting changed a few years ago in a GAA dressing room. For, it was a Creggan he played for. And all of a sudden, four Republicans arrived at the dressing room door, eyeballed him and handed him this leaflet warning him not to join the PSNI. And then there is a car bomb placed beneath his car and it goes off. And I'm going to read out how Joe describes it here. It's steel yourself, listener, because it's extremely blunt and blunt and plain prose, but it's kind of brutal at the same time. His arse had been blown off, literally blown off. At that point, it seemed certain he would die. The snow and ice had staunched the hemorrhaging as he lay on the road, keeping him alive until the ambulance appeared. But now the blood was pumping out. 140 units were transfused into him. It went in one end and out the other. His ruined right leg was amputated. The surgeons at the Royal Victoria filleted the bone from the flesh, discarded the bone, and used the flesh and tissue to make a new arse for him to sit on, like stitching a rubber ring to his waist. For 3 weeks, he hovered between life and death. Then the doctors brought him out of the coma. And it goes on like that. And then you mentioned the restrained anger. Joe's line later on is just after he joined the PSNI football GAA team, he set it up and then they played a challenge match against a club, St. Bridget's Club, who might actually be Brawley's club. And I think it was 2006. And then Joe's line is, just over 3 years later, people from his own community set Pádraig up for assassination, crawled under his car in the dead of night, and planted a bomb to free Ireland.
Yeah. No, it's like, it was nominated for Sports Story of the Year a couple of years ago, and I was astonished it didn't win.
It's incredible.
It's one of the most incredible pieces I've ever read. No, to call it a sports piece even doesn't give us. It's just, it's a piece about Ireland, a very stark portrait of part of Ireland. And you know, there's things he says in this, like he's convinced he knows who did it, and the people he knew, and you know, possibly was friendly with, and that possibly played with, you know, which it's just it's hard to believe, you know, that this went on just up the road and like not that long ago. You know, the way Joe finishes it up, you know, we sit for a good while after that, sipping tea, saying nothing. Then he chit-chats about his wife Fiona and the football. We arrange to go out for a meal together over Christmas. This is the first time he's spoken publicly about his life. As we're about to leave, I ask him, what's your life like? He says, it's a life, but it's not my life. You know, that should be on the Leaving Cert curriculum. You know, I'm actually being honest about that. Like, whatever the equivalent of civics is now, or in the history, or in English, it should be that tells you a lot about Ireland and where Ireland has been in the last 50 years.
I know, listener, I know we've gone into these pieces in quite a lot of depth, we kind of probably don't usually go into, but I will tweet them all out and you can read them, and they're all like, there is plenty more in all these pieces that we haven't touched on, and they're definitely worth reading. Right, Kieran, returning from home, this is the quickfire question section of the show. We've got list of questions in from listeners in our WhatsApp group. If you do want to do so for future guests and future episodes, join the WhatsApp group. The details are in the description of this episode. So there's two here. Kian asks, what are the big differences when writing for a tabloid versus writing for a broadsheet?
Well, to me, I make no distinction. That's being honest, because like in terms of length, you would, because like you rarely get over 1,000 words. But if it was something really, really strong, like I have got up to 2,500 words at times. But you know, generally it would be about 1,000 to 1,200 words max. But like to me, tabloid is just a format. It's like online is a format, broadsheet is a format. It doesn't mean it's lesser in any way. Like, it's one of the things I didn't agree with in the newspaper awards a couple of years ago. They changed the sports writing category to having a broadsheet winner and a popular, what they call popular newspaper winner. And I thought there was an element, like, I believe tabloids actually pushed for this, but I never agreed with it, because to me, people will look at that and say the real winner is the broadsheet winner. Mm. Like, whereas if you're good enough to win, you're good enough to win. It doesn't matter if it's tabloid, broadsheet, whatever. But to me, there's no difference. Like, I think, you know, you look at a lot of the best sports writers, the most celebrated sports writers, they use very plain language. You know, it's not about using words of 4 or 5 syllables. You know, that's that doesn't make you a broadsheet writer.
Well, as Joe Brolly piece is evidence of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's because people, the odd time you would talk to younger journalists, and the advice I would always give is read a lot, because I find that sometimes journalists don't read enough. And to improve as a writer, you have to be a reader. And also you have to read broadly, like don't just read sport, read everything. You know, read novels, read history, read music, read, you know, just read a bit of everything, like broaden your knowledge.
Yeah, the film director Werner Herzog used to be, but he'd always be asked for advice, and he'd always dispense it in, well, how many words of advice do you want? And they'd say like 7. And he'd reply, well, read. You've probably touched on this question that Darren Mulvey has asked in your previous answer, Kieran, but is there a sense of inferiority, especially in press boxes, in the tabloid versus broadsheet debate, in your opinion?
I've never felt that, to be honest. That might be more of a UK thing. Like, there does seem to be more attention in the UK. Like if you go, like, look at the award, you know, in terms of awards, I think a lot of tabloid writers don't enter because I think there is, it's very much a broadsheet thing. But I've never seen the tension here. And also, I've seen people navigate here. Like people, a fair few people have gone from tabloids to, like Dermot Crowe, for just one example comes to my head. He used to work for The Star, he works for Sunday Independent now. And there's a fairly seamless transition. Like there's no, they're well able to do it. So I've never noticed that here. You know, there's poor writers in tabloids, there's poor writers in broadsheets, there's good writers in tabloids, there's good writers in broadsheets. It's just a format.
Mm. Okay, 3 last questions. Kieran, the most interesting place you've been through with work, been to with work?
Iran.
Ah, for the playoff?
Yeah. No, that was really strange. Like, it was just a complete culture shock. I remember one day I was with a photographer, Gary Ash from The Star, and we were going looking for some fans, you know, just to do a piece or something. So I think we went to Bobby Sands Street, where the British Embassy is in Tehran. We were driving around, but we went to the bazaar, the famous bazaar, and it's incredible. It's incredibly easy to get lost in it. Like it is chaos, like it is, and it's so big. And we got cornered by this guy, and he said, you know, come with us, you know, we'll buy a carpet. And we're thinking, yeah, we know we could get a few pics of this. It's maybe decent buying a Persian carpet. But he took us down this warren of, you know, we were walking for ages in and around different corners. And we went into this room with 2 other men. And there's so 3 of them and 2 of us. And we hadn't a clue where we were. And you're just thinking, what the hell are we at? Like, and so they're offering us, they are giving us this horrible, really strong tea. And eventually I bought a little rug, was like a doormat just to get out of there. But I just, it was like there was a shebeen up in the hills, and some people went to it because obviously alcohol was disallowed. And they just thought, you're taking a bit of a risk, lads, you know, chance that you're around doing this in Tehran. But
yeah,
and the night itself, like very quickly, the game, it was a huge stadium, it held about 100,000 people. Most of them were in there from about 12 noon. And then, like, it was whatever it was, 8 o'clock kickoff. And they built themselves up into a frenzy. Like, it's kind of a call and response thing all day, from one end of the ground to the other. And then there was a huge picture of Ayatollah Khomeini at the center circle, up high up in one of the stands. And then all sorts of missiles were thrown at Shea Given during the game. Then afterwards, when Ireland had qualified, we were going towards, I remember we were driving the bus towards the airport, and the road in front of us was gleaming. Was glittering. It was like ice or something. I was wondering, what the hell is it? It was broken glass everywhere. The supporters, after they'd been knocked out, there was cars in a traffic jam out of the ground, and they just walked, you know, broke the windows as they walked past all the cars. So we were very glad to get out of there, I have to say.
Tehran confetti. If Roy Keane is listening, that is the trip you missed out on, Roy. Hope you don't regret it. Most interesting person you've met through work?
One more, Gavin.
Oh, go ahead.
The pre-match press conference was the best question ever was asked at that press conference by an Iranian journalist. he said to Mick McCarthy, are you the Republic of Ireland or the Republic of Roy King? And you could still ask that question.
That's amazing. God. Most interesting person you've met through work, Kieran?
Mick Murphy, who was known as the Iron Man. He was a cyclist from the 1950s. But you come across, like, you're always looking for a decent interview. And what, there was a history of the Ross and Ross Tulch in the cycling race brought out about 15, 20 years ago. I can't remember when. But there's a little bit about a winner from the 1950s called Mick Murphy. And, you know, to put it mildly, a colourful character. Like, he drank cow's blood. He lived in the open and all this kind of stuff. So I eventually managed to track him down. Like, and the door of this little hovel was a sheet of corrugated iron. He had no electricity, no running water, no heat. And he just had an amazing story. Like, he was a circus strongman. He'd read about Maasai warriors who used to drink blood by slitting a vein on the neck of cattle and drinking from it. And he did this. He used to sleep in the hills in Kerry. And he'd do this, like, he'd go down and drink blood from the necks of cows. So he just had these astonishing stories. And, you know, he just some great lines. He said, the others didn't like me because I made racing too hard. Like, he was a brutal cyclist. Like, he was very much at the top here when it was a very big sport for 3 or 4 years. And then he just, he was more interested in being a wrestler or a circus strongman. He would often England to that, you know, but there's just, he's just full of stories. And, it was a very strange experience because it was in January. I went down there. It was very cold. He'd got a couple of cans of beer, which he wanted me to drink, which I was trying not to. And I got a taxi. It was outside Carstavine somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And I told the taxi man to come back at a certain time. And it was just stepping into another world. It was, yeah. You know, he died a couple of years ago. Like, he would have been a good age at the time. It was very vague even what age he was when he died. Like, he was.
Yeah.
But he was the most interesting, yeah.
And did you make sure that was it definitely beer in that can and not some kind of strange?
I managed to worm my way out of it. I can't remember.
Right, our final question is admittedly not a very nice one, and no one really likes it, but we ask it anyway. If you had written just one of the four pieces that you submitted today, which one would it be?
God, that's a good one. The Powder Heffron one.
Yeah,
it's the most important, I think.
Kieran, thanks so much. That was an absolute pleasure. God, we yammered on for very long, but it was great.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks very much to Kieran. A reminder, you can get in touch with us. Email behindthelines@the42.ie, tweet me @GQNE93, or get involved in the WhatsApp group. Details of that are in the episode description below. That's it for this week's podcast. We're going to be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.